It is now my privilege to introduce Brother Joe Migas, and he has selected for his talk, you can see it, or we'll see it soon on the screen, Nay, But We Will Have a King. Nay, But We Will Have a King.
Thank you, Brother Jack, Brother Greg, and Sister Florence. The words of our title, Nay, But We Will Have a King, are taken from 1 Samuel 8, verse 19. Let's read the account in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 1 through 22. And it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes, and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, and came to Samuel unto Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel, when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voice. Howbeit, yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands, and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. And he will take your fields, and your vineyards, and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards, and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants, and your goodliest young men and your asses, and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, Hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. Why, after having judges for 450 years, did God's chosen people want a king instead? This morning we're going to answer that question and also gain lessons from this transition from Israel's judges to kings in three separate contexts. First, lessons gained from the Bible account of the nation of Israel, both in history and in prophecy. What actually happened to that people, and what is foretold to happen to that people as a result of their transition from judges to kings. Second, lessons gained from the modern secular history of the Gentile nations and Bible prophecy, particularly beginning with the end of the Gentile times in 1914. And third, lessons for spiritual Israel, the church class, us, today. We're going to cover a lot of material, especially in the second part of our discourse, so I will need not only this hour, but also the third session of our day to finish this discussion. But before we explore the lessons in Israel's desire to have a king in these three contexts, let's first understand the motives in Israel's desire to have a king. Again, our initial question, why after having judges for so many years did God's chosen people want a king instead? Now, the first and obvious answer to that question was given to us in 1 Samuel 8:3. Samuel had become old and unable to do the work of judging all of Israel by himself, so he appointed his sons, Joel and Abiah, to help him by acting as deputy judges in Beersheba, a rather remote section in the southern part of the country that would have been difficult for Samuel to get to by himself. But his sons took bribes and were corrupt, so the people did not respect them. Now, while all that was true, what the people of Israel should have wanted then was simply better judges, honest men who would be fair and impartial in administering the duties of their office. But the real reasons, the underlying motives why Israel wanted a king, was prompted by something else. The real reasons Israel wanted a king are given in verse 20, and there are three of them. Real reason number one why Israel wanted a king was that we may be like all the nations. Now, in fact, Israel already had a king, and his name was Jehovah. God ruled the Jewish nation through a covenant of laws which they were to keep. So the Jewish form of government was a theocracy. God was their king, and all the people were equal under the law covenant. And that form of government made the Jewish people different from everyone else, all the other nations on the earth, which were ruled by wealthy kings who lived in great palaces and sat on golden thrones and were prominently visible to the people in parades and at feasts, and especially when the king led his armies into war against another enemy nation. The glory of the king made the people feel that they too shared in that glory. It gave the Gentile peoples pride in their nations. And the children of Israel envied the trappings of monarchy and national pride that these other nations so greatly enjoyed. So we can readily understand this first underlying motive why the people wanted a king. They wanted to be like everyone else, like all the other nations. You know, it's hard to be different from everyone else around you, particularly when others seem to have it better than you do. And Israel did not realize that their very differences and separateness from the nations around them would be crucial to the survival of their national identity later on when they were scattered among the Gentile nations. But that realization would eventually come. Reason number two why Israel wanted a king was that our king may judge us. We said before that Samuel's sons were corrupt and unfit to serve as judges. That was reason enough to want better judges. But I think there is a second aspect to this desire to have a king judge Israel. God had given his people the law, and it was everyone's individual responsibility to keep the law, judge themselves in accordance with that law, and act righteously, so that very few disputes would arise that required a judge to resolve them. The people of Israel were all charged with knowing the law and disciplining themselves to keep the law. And the more they did so, the less they would even need those judges to resolve their disputes. As we said earlier, Israel was a theocracy ruled by an invisible God and governed by unchanging laws. But instead, the people of Israel wanted a monarchy ruled by a visible king and judged and governed by whatever the king said at the time he said it, even though the king could change his mind and contradict tomorrow whatever he declared today. In this, the people were abdicating their responsibility to know the law and to keep it. They wanted someone else to have the responsibility of making their decisions for them and telling them what to do. Real reason number three why Israel wanted a king was that he may go out before us and fight our battles. In the book of Judges, we read how Israel had firsthand experience multiple times with the armies of other nations coming against them and defeating them, taking some of them captive. So Israel wanted a more effective national defense. They wanted to be able to fight fire with fire, our king and our army against your king and your army. The lesson they were supposed to learn, however, was to fight fire with obedience to God's laws. Or more correctly, to avoid the need to fight battles by obedience to God's laws, because it was punishment for Israel's failure to obey God's laws that the surrounding nations were permitted to invade Israel and overcome them. Obedience to God's laws would have given Israel the best possible national defense, an impenetrable shield against all enemies. But instead of relying on their God to be their protector, the children of Israel disobeyed him and wanted to rely on their own might by having a highly visible king and his army to go before them into battle. So those are the real answers, the real reasons, the underlying motives as to why, after 450 years of judges, the people of Israel wanted a king. And we're going to see those same three underlying motives repeated in our later lessons as well. So now let's consider the first of the three contexts in which we can gain lessons from Israel's desire to have a king, namely the Bible account of the nation of Israel, both in history and in prophecy. As we know from the later scriptural accounts, Samuel, the last judge of the nation of Israel, eventually anointed Saul of the tribe of Benjamin to be their first king. For a time, the transition from judges to kings seemed to be a positive step. Saul was mighty in battle, and David was even mightier. The glory of Solomon's kingdom and the temple that he built were known around the world. Israel was now a world superpower. Everything that Israel had wanted in having a king had become theirs in just a little over 100 years. But there was a price. As Samuel had warned, the people would be conscripted into the service of the king to build his palaces and to plant his fields and to serve him in many ways. And so during the relative peace and prosperity of the reign of Solomon, there was oppression, intrigues, plots, and assassinations, which resulted in the nation of Israel dividing into the two-tribe kingdom of Judah in the south, ruled by Solomon's son Rehoboam, and the ten-tribe kingdom of Israel to the north, ruled by Jeroboam, a mighty man of valor from the tribe of Ephraim. As just one account of the fulfillment of Samuel's warning, we have the passage in 1 Kings chapter 12, which follows immediately after Solomon's death. I'll read 1 Kings 12, verses 1 to 11, 16 and 19. And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass, when Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, that they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake unto Rehoboam, saying, Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee. And he, Rehoboam, said unto them, Depart yet for 3 days. Then come again to me, And the people departed. And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived and said, "How do ye advise that I may answer this people?" And they spake unto him, saying, "If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and wilt serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants forever." But he forsook the counsel of the old men, which they had given him, and consulted with the young men that were grown up with him, which stood before him. And he said unto them, "What counsel give ye, that we may answer this people?" And the young men that were grown up with him spake unto him, saying, "Thus shalt thou speak unto this people, My little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. And whereas my father did lade you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father has chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." In verses 12 to 15, which we won't read, Rehoboam answers as the young men had advised him. So we'll skip down to verses 16 and 19 after Rehoboam's answer. "So when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, the people answered the king, saying, 'What portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel! Now see to thine own house, David.' So Israel departed unto their tents. And so Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day." In the centuries that followed, both the 10-tribe kingdom of Israel and the 2-tribe kingdom of Judah kept not the law covenant and fell into idolatry, among other sins. So about 300 years later, in 721 BC, the Assyrians invaded the 10-tribe kingdom of Israel and took the people captive to Assyria. Later in 606 BC, the Babylonians invaded the 2-tribe kingdom of Judah and took the remaining Israelites and their last king captive to Babylon. So now, what are the lessons we can gain in this first of the three contexts of the reasons why Israel said, "Nay, but we will have a king"? Recapping the lessons, first, as we already noted, it's hard to be different from everyone around you, particularly when others seem to have it better than you do. But that was God's arrangement. And the very separateness and differentness that Israel had was what preserved them as a nation later on, as we'll see when we get into their prophecies. Second, having a human king rather than Jehovah to reign over them concentrated power in the hands of one man instead of in God's law, under which all men were equal. And it was this equality of all men under God's law that was the hallmark and the best feature of the arrangement they had with their God. Further, having power in the hands of one man led to a divisive fight for that power. Until they had a king, they were all in harmony and united under God's law. But now, there came this fight for power, as we saw with Rehoboam and Jeroboam. You know, Israel wanted to be like the other nations. And that's exactly what happened to Israel. They indeed became just like the other nations, having an oppressive monarchy which led them astray and was ultimately powerless to protect them from their enemies. Like all the other mighty nations that came and went, the kingdom and the nation of Israel was no more. And I'm sure Samuel, who of course was long dead by this time, if he had been there, would have said, "I warned you, be careful what you wish for, because you might just receive it." And since I'll turn 70 years old later this year, this next lesson is my favorite. Old people give the best advice. Although I hasten to add, If the advice is given according to God's word and the Holy Spirit, then the age of the advice giver really doesn't matter. But while the kingdom and the nation of Israel was no more, it was all according to God's foreknowledge. Indeed, God foretold that Israel would want a king 500 years before the time of Samuel. Let's look at a scripture Sister Kathy called to my attention as I was researching this discourse, Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 and 15. Where at the time of the Exodus from Egypt, God gives Moses these instructions for the children of Israel. When thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, meaning go ahead and do it. Whom the Lord thy God shall choose, one from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. So here God says, I know someday you'll want a king, and you'll have a king. I'll give you a king. Just make sure your king is one of thy brethren, a Hebrew and not a Gentile. But then the question begs to be asked, if God wanted Israel to have judges instead of kings, why did he even open the door to having a king by saying this to Moses? You can have a king as long as he isn't a Gentile. I think, perhaps, it was because God can use even the errant wanderings of his children to bring forth lessons for their long-term benefit. God's arrangement for Israel was a theocracy with human judges and its earthly representatives. But Israel wanted a king. God foreknew this and told the people through Moses that when the time comes, give them the king that they want, but make sure that their king was a Hebrew whom God had chosen. In this regard, Brother Russell has an interesting comment in reprint 4193. He said, judges developed the Israelites individually, the kingdom, their nation under the kings, tended to develop them along national lines. Individual development, collective development. We'll revisit these concepts a little later in our discussion of lessons for the church class today. So that's the review of the history of Israel connected with their desire to have a king, and the experiences that the nation endured as a result of that desire, culminating with their destruction as a nation. So now let's consider a few of the many prophecies concerning Israel related to their restoration as a nation. The scriptures are filled with prophecies regarding the eventual restoration of Israel to bless all mankind in the kingdom, and one of those is found in Jeremiah 30. We'll read just three verses, Jeremiah 30, verses 3, 18 and 22. For lo, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will bring again the captivity of my people, Israel and Judah, 10 tribes and 2 tribes, saith the Lord, and I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it once again. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring again the captivity of Jacob's tents and have mercy on his dwelling places, and the city shall be builded upon her own heap, and the palace shall remain after the manner thereof. And ye shall be my people, and I will be your God. We've already seen the beginnings of the fulfillment of this and other similar prophecies in the Berlin Congress of Nations in 1878, the Balfour Declaration of 1917, and the birth of the modern state of Israel in 1948. Another important prophecy is found in Micah 5, verses 2 and 5, speaking of the time when our returned Lord, along with his church, will fight for Israel and save her. Micah 5, 2 and 5. But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from old, from everlasting. And this man shall be the peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land, And when he shall tread in our palaces, then shall we raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 principal men. The fulfillment of this prophecy is yet future, since the 7 shepherds are the completed church, and the 8 principal men, or princes of men, refer to the resurrected ancient worthies who will fight and win the final decisive battle against Israel's enemies. And after that battle is won, Isaiah 1:26 tells us, "And I will restore thy judges as at the first, and thy counselors as at the beginning." Notice that restored Israel will be as it was at the first, with judges, namely the resurrected ancient worthies, as the earthly phase of the kingdom, acting as representatives of the glorified Christ, head and body, kings and priests in heaven. And so we end this first portion of our discourse with the thought that although the people of Israel unwisely wanted to be like the other nations, Israel will be unlike all the other nations, in that they alone will be restored, not only to their former glory under Solomon, but to a glory that will endure forever in the everlasting kingdom on earth for which we all pray. Now let's move on to the second of the 3 main divisions of our discourse, and fast forward in time to lessons from modern history of the Gentile nations in Israel's desire to have a king. And there will be 2 underlying themes in this section of our discourse. First, we're going to see that this desire to have a king or strong leader was not unique to Israel in Old Testament times, but rather seems to be a common sentiment among nations. Even when nations had democracy in their hands, they said, "Nay, but we will have a king." Not a king in the traditional sense of a royal house, but a king in the sense of a strong man or powerful leader. And, as it was with Israel, the consequences of that desire to have a king or strong leader were often negative. The second underlying theme will be that history repeats itself. Now, as a preview of where I'm going with this discourse, here's a roadmap. We're going to connect an unlikely series of dots from Benito Mussolini to Adolf Hitler to Revelation 12, where I'll present a secondary application to a well-known scripture, to Vladimir Putin, to Ezekiel 38, where I'll suggest an interpretation you've never heard before of the spoil Gog comes to take. Then we'll take a quick side trip to China and finish in Revelation 17 with some comments by Brother Chester Sunbaum. I said it was an unlikely collection of dots. But the line that connects those dots will trace the rise of dictatorships and totalitarian governments in the last days of this present evil world, and a downward line in the opposite direction will trace the death of truth. Not truth in the biblical sense of true doctrines, which cannot die, but truth in the secular sense, according to the politics of the time. It's going to seem like a lengthy journey. We won't even finish it in this first session of our discourse, but at the end of it, I promise, I'll connect it all to the lessons from the 3 underlying motivations in Israel's desire to have a king. We begin in the year 1914, when the Gentile times ended and the royal houses of Europe were overthrown, sometimes with the exile or the deaths of the royal family. Now, prior to the Great War, later called World War I, diplomats from Britain secretly promised Italy certain lands which they had lost over the preceding centuries if Italy would not join Germany in the war. And Italy had already been an ally of Germany. Britain was asking them to stand down, renege on your promise to Germany, and don't join them in the coming war against Britain. Italy agreed, And when the guns of August began their bombardment, Italy remained largely neutral in the conflict, as this newspaper front page of August 1, 1914 indicates. The top headline announces the start of the Great War, but of particular interest is the lower article with the headline, Italy Breaks Triple Alliance, meaning that on the day the war started, Italy left its two former allies, Germany and Austro-Hungary, which had declared war on Britain. But after the war, Britain reneged on its promise to Italy. The end of World War I and the Treaty of Versailles gave Italy much less land than it was promised. The Italians felt cheated and humiliated as a people and as a nation. In the days of the Roman Empire, two millennia earlier, Italy had been the greatest nation the world had ever seen. Now it was nothing compared to the British Empire, which had lied to them to keep them out of the Great War. It was this humiliation, a loss of pride in one's country, a feeling that a former greatness had been lost, that gave rise to the Italian people saying, "Nay, but we will have a king over us." Although in the 20th century, the kings were no longer descendants of a royal bloodline, but rather were dictators given power by the very people they later oppressed. And the rise of dictators follows a similar pattern in whatever country the dictator rises, as we'll soon see. Italy's government after the war was a democracy. In 1919, for the first time in its history, every adult male could vote to elect the country's leaders. The result was the formation of a government divided between two opposing parties, one linked to the conservative Catholic Church and the other to a liberal socialist party. The hopelessly divided government led to a divided people, all of whom were unhappy with their national leadership. The Italian people were restless. Workers began to strike, and threats of revolution grew. By 1922, a socialist named Benito Mussolini created a new political party he called the Fascist Party, which advocated strict government control of labor and industry. Mussolini promised to restore order to the country and make Italy great again, recapture the glory days of ancient Rome, and right the wrong done to Italy by the treaty ending the war. The fascists organized young people, workers and employers into groups, pledging loyalty not only to the country, government, or party, but to Mussolini personally, who took the title Il Duce, the leader. The people had a democratic government, but said to themselves, "Nay, but we will have a king, a dictator." Upon rising to power, the fascists used terror and secret police to control opposition. They controlled the press, radio, and schools, becoming skilled in the use of propaganda, the spreading of lies, to keep the people from learning the ugly truth about the fascist activities and failures. Now let's consider developments in Germany after World War I. In June of 1919, a treaty was signed in Versailles, France, setting forth the terms of the end of the war. And the terms were a crushing blow to Germany. It included what came to be called the War Guilt Clause, forcing Germany to accept the entire responsibility for starting the war and requiring Germany to pay, in today's money, $450 billion in reparations to the victors, an impossible sum. And the treaty took away 25,000 square miles of land and 7 million people, which were part of the former German Empire. It was a total humiliation of the German people. The head of the newly formed German government resigned rather than sign that lopsided treaty. His replacement tried to negotiate better terms, only to be told that the guns would resume their bombardment of Germany if he did not sign the treaty. So having no other choice, he did. A new constitutional German government called the Weimar Republic was formed, named for the city where the new constitution was drafted. and it was a representative democracy. Germany was no longer ruled by an emperor or Kaiser. The people were responsible for choosing their own rulership. Under the terms of their new constitution, Germany was a democracy and the people had the right to vote. At this time, a young military courier named Adolf Hitler, witnessing the galling humbling of the once mighty German Empire, resolved to do something about it. A fiery orator, he formed a political party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or Nazi Party, and drew hundreds of ardent followers by promising the people that he would make Germany great again, in a Third Reich or Third Empire, looking back at the Holy Roman Empire as the First Reich and the German Empire as the Second Reich. Observing the success of Italy's dictator, Hitler modeled his Nazi party after the fascist party led by Mussolini, dressing his men in black shirts like Mussolini's brown-shirted militia and taking the title Der Führer, the leader, like Mussolini's title Il Duce. Like the Italian fascists, the Nazis used terror and secret police to suppress opposition. They controlled the press, radio, and schools and became skilled in the use of propaganda, the spreading of lies to keep the people from learning the horrific truth about the Nazis' activities and failures. While they had much in common as dictators, there were a few differences between Mussolini and Hitler. Mussolini's oratory was eloquent and passionate. Hitler's was angry and crude. Mussolini blamed England for deception in promising Italy more land than they received after the war, and Hitler blamed the Jews for Germany's economic decline during the Great Depression. But they both were given power by the voters of their respective countries, who chose them over more moderate and diplomatically experienced leaders. The voters in Italy and Germany wanted a king, a strong leader who would solve their problems of economic distress, unemployment, and national shame after the end of World War I. Both Hitler and Mussolini followed the same path to power. They started out as demagogues, fiery speakers who spoke to the shame and the anger of the electorate, with promises to make their countries great again, and blamed other peoples for their national woes. Their countries had a democracy after the war, but gave it up. And so the voters elected candidates from the parties of the demagogues, the Fascist Party in Italy and the Nazi Party in Germany, and gave them power to run the government. Once the demagogues' parties got a little power from the voters, they schemed to gain more and more power until they became authoritarian, a regime that held strict and complete control over the people, commerce, the military, and even the press. And this is important. Eventually, Mussolini and Hitler transcended the government and the political parties they once belonged to and demanded the people's loyalty to them personally, not to the party or even to the government or to the nation, but to them personally, Il Duce and Der Führer. Thus, the demagogues became dictators, and the voters who gave them their initial power bore the result of their mistake. This now is the connection to the first of the three underlying motivations in Israel's desire to have a king, so that they could be like the other nations. The Italian and German peoples wanted a king, a strong man, a powerful leader, who would make their country not only like or equal to the other nations, but superior to them, a world power, once again, like they once were, respected and even feared by the other nations of the world. Moving forward in time, the last half of the 20th century saw the rise of many more dictators around the world. Among them are the names you see on the screen. I won't read them, but there are these and many more, some of which were voted into power, while others seized power unlawfully. But the important observation to make is that dictators love and admire other dictators. Dictators copy each other's moves, their methods, and approve them, much to the sorrow and dismay of the people that they rule. Now let's consider our next dot. In Revelation 12 is the account of the church class, pictured by a woman, being persecuted by Satan, pictured by a dragon or serpent. In verses 15 and 16 of Revelation 12, we read, "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth." In volume 3, pages 65 to 67, Brother Russell explains this verse as describing an attempt by Satan to overwhelm the saints of God with a flood of secular truth. Here's a short quote. "Satan's design in instigating the French Revolution was to create an alarm throughout Europe, especially among the influential class unfavorable to liberty, and to illustrate in France the theory that, were the superstitions of Rome to be overthrown and liberty to be given full sway, all law and order would speedily end. This was a masterstroke of policy, worthy of its author, and designed, as the prophet shows, to overwhelm the woman, the Reformed Church, and to drive all conservatives and peace lovers, rulers and ruled, back to union and harmony with papacy. The failure of this scheme was not due to lack of craftiness in its designer, but to the overruling power of God, whereby he is able to make all things work together for good." So Revelation 12:15 foretells how Satan spoke through the thought leaders of the late 1700s, such as Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire, and infused society with true enlightened thinking on the rights of man, intending to provoke a revolution by the masses against the established church-state systems, which would then serve as an excuse for a crackdown on liberty and dissent by the ruling powers, both civil and religious, thus halting the spread of truth. And as Brother Russell pointed out in the excerpt I just read, Satan's plot backfired. The secular truths were absorbed by the stable masses of society, bringing liberty and religious freedom instead of the suppression of dissent and oppression of the true church. The creation of Bible societies in the early 1800s published and distributed God's word in every known language of the time. Now that is no doubt the primary interpretation and application of Revelation 12, 15, and 16. But now I would like to suggest an echo of this verse, a secondary application 200 years later, in the time of the 20th and 21st century dictators. In this echo application, Satan is once again trying to sow chaos and hurt to the truth and the church with a flood of water. But Satan doesn't make the same mistake twice. This time, the water is not pure water, true enlightened thinking, as in the 1700s, but rather it is polluted water, propaganda and lies, coming from Satan through Mussolini, Hitler, and later, as we'll see, Vladimir Putin. You know, Hitler was a master of propaganda. In 1925, he wrote this in his manifesto entitled Mein Kampf, which translates into English as My Struggle. Propaganda must always address itself to the broad masses of the people. All propaganda must be presented in a popular form and must fix its intellectual level so as not to be above the heads of the least intellectual of those to whom it is directed. The art of propaganda consists precisely in being able to awaken the imagination of the public through an appeal to their feelings, in finding the appropriate psychological form that will arrest the attention and appeal to the hearts of the national masses. Propaganda must not investigate the truth objectively, The receptive powers of the masses are very restricted, and their understanding is feeble. On the other hand, they quickly forget. Such being the case, all effective propaganda must be confined to a few bare essentials, and those must be expressed as far as possible in stereotyped formulas. These slogans should be persistently repeated until the very last individual has come to grasp the idea that has been put forward. He wrote that almost 100 years ago. And this now is the connection of the 20th century history to the second of the three underlying motivations in Israel's desire to have a king, which was to have a king to judge them, or in a more modern context, to tell them what to do. Mussolini, and to a much greater extent Hitler, knew that success in telling people what to do begins with telling people what to think and what to believe. And that's the purpose of propaganda. If you believe the Jews are an inferior race, not even really fully human, then you will have no hesitation to kill all Jews and any other undesirables, because you believe doing so is the right thing and it will make the world a better place. And you know, this propaganda did not only affect the Jews who were murdered in the concentration camps. Kathy and I had the somber privilege of touring the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., as well as the prison camp in Auschwitz, Poland. We learned that the prisoners were sorted into groups and given a cloth badge or emblem to wear to identify them. Jews wore a yellow Star of David. Another group deemed to be undesirables were Jehovah's Witnesses, who were made to wear a purple triangle sewn onto their prison garb. But in the names of the groups, according to the Nazi records, the name Jehovah's Witnesses does not appear in connection with the purple triangle. Rather, the name of the group that wore that insignia in German is Bibelforscher, which translates into English as Bible student. So Revelation 12:15, in this secondary echo application, describes how Satan spoke to the people through his servants, Mussolini and Hitler, and cast out of their mouths a flood of propaganda and lies, hoping to destroy the Jewish race, natural Israel, as well as the church class, spiritual Israel, through persecution and death in the extermination camps of Eastern Europe. And in this secondary application of Revelation 12:15 to the time of Hitler, we see the same failure of Satan's scheme that Pastor Russell observed in the primary application in the time of the French Revolution. Remember his statement we read earlier from Volume 3, page 65. The failure of the scheme, Satan's scheme, was not due to lack of craftiness in its designer, but to the overruling power of God, whereby he is able to cause all things to work together for good. The earth, in this secondary application of Revelation 12:16, again pictures the masses of the peoples who swallowed up the lies and believed them, which in an ironic and unintended way helped the church to make their calling and election sure and the nation of Israel to be restored. Because I have no doubt that some of our consecrated, spirit-begotten brethren were prisoners in the German concentration camps, Bible students. And as they removed their worn and dirty prisoner's uniform with the purple triangle upon entering the gas chambers, they emerged on the other side of the veil, clothed in clean white robes and wearing crowns of gold. Indeed, precious in the sight of God was the death of his saints, and further, the death of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust, which brought about the birth of the modern state of Israel. Once again, Satan lost. Our time is up for this first session. We'll break here and resume at 12:15 when we complete our discussion of the rise of the dictators and totalitarianism by connecting the last four of our dots. And then, I've saved the best for last, lessons for all of us, the church class, today.